Hello, and welcome to Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. I'm a music researcher currently getting a PhD at the University of Michigan. I'm studying music theory, and I'm also a vocalist. Therefore, I use this show to talk all things music, and I have guests on the show to talk about what they do in music as well. Today on the show, I have a conversation with Dr. Jan Miyake. She's a professor of music theory at Oberlin College, and currently the president of the Society for Music Theory. We talk all about her musical upbringing and her experiences as a violist. We chat about how she got interested in music theory and her time in grad school at CUNY. And we talk all about some pedagogy that she's currently experimenting with at Oberlin, including her course titled Questioning Genius. We also finish up with a conversation about mentoring. So what makes a good mentor? What makes a mentee? You can find the links to everything that we mention in the show notes. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of the podcast. We are starting off Women's History Month with a bunch of guests that are coming up that I'm really excited about. But today we're going to talk to Dr. Jan Miyake. Jan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. And I can't wait to hear all about what you're thinking about and working on and how everything is going as the president of SMT.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm excited to be here.
Sure, sure. And I will say it was really great last month at the annual meeting to meet you in person. So that was our first time meeting in person. But I also recall, you know, I normally kind of start off the podcast by talking about how I came to be introduced to a guest or their work or whatever. And I remember, I guess it was back during my first year at Michigan, that you had emailed me and we're just like, hi, I'm Jan. And I was like, oh, that's really nice. And it was really sweet of you to just introduce yourself to me and, you know, offer yourself as just a support, a resource, as somebody who was, you know, back in my first year. So thank you so much for reaching out to me. It was so nice of you to do that.
You're welcome. I actually was curious how we got started also. So I dragged through my email correspondence and you had written, I think, Cora Palfi about a website, Women in Music, you had run into.
Yes, that's right.
You had a bunch of ideas. And at that time, I was the chair of was formerly called the Committee on the Status of Women. Mm-hmm. And she forwarded me your email. And I read it. I said, oh, how cool. I really like this person. I hope they stay in music theory. And so I wrote you an email that said, hi, I'm Jan.
Yes.
Welcome to the That's how it got started.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. Shout out to you. And I can also think of Dr. Naomi Andre, who did the same mm-hmm. thing, especially because she was still at Michigan at the time of my first year. So she reached out to me as well, which was fantastic. So let's start off the podcast with talking a bit about you and your background in music. So if you could inform me and the listeners where you are from and the music that was happening in the place where you're from when you were growing up, if you're from a musical family, if there are other musicians in your family, formal or informal musicians, and the things that you were interested in as a kid in terms of music, what you were listening to and what you gravitated towards.
Great. So I would say I'm from a very musical family. I'm also kind of the black sheep of the family. I'm the only one who's not a high school or secondary school music educator.
Wow.
I'm the only one who's not a high school or junior high school music educator.
Hmm.
And so I have come from a very large family and lots of teachers, lots of non-teachers too. But for those of us who went into music, we're all teaching. And I'm the black sheep that decided to get a PhD and teach at the college level.
Hmm.
So I grew up, my earliest years were in Denver, Colorado. And I would say that my soundscape there was the Carpenters.
Sure.
loved the Carpenters. That being said, my dad was a very talented high school choir conductor, and I went to all of his concerts, and that was very traditional choral music from the classical style. My mom was an orchestra teacher and a violist, and she's still a violist. She's retired now as an orchestra teacher. And she played in local orchestras. So when we lived in Little Rock, Arkansas, she played in the Arkansas Symphony. And I went to all of those concerts too. And so while my soundscape at home was definitely like kind of a folk sound, as far as I remember it, anytime I went with my parents to work, it was classical music. So they started me on piano when I was 4.
Wow.
And then I was invited to pick up a second instrument if I wanted to when I was 7. And I chose the viola because my mom played the viola. So I wanted to play the viola too. And the rest is kind of history. I sang in choirs and stuff like that because my dad was a choral director. But I became pretty serious about the viola in, I would say, 8th-ish grade, 7th, 8th grade. At that time, we were living in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I just, it was fun. It was all my friends were great musicians. I loved youth orchestra. I got very serious about it. And that took me to Oberlin College for my undergraduate work. I applied to lots of schools, and the one that was supposed to be the hardest to get into was the only one that took me. So everyone was a little baffled, including me. And so I had a great experience at Oberlin. I was in the double degree program. I earned a Bachelor of Arts in Mathematics and a Bachelor of Music in Viola Performance, along with a minor in music theory, which was an insane lift. It was the core
Wow.
curriculum, and it was 6 upper division courses after the core curriculum. So, and after that, I applied to grad schools and I chose CUNY for a lot of reasons. One was that one of my most influential undergraduate teachers, Bill Rothstein, had moved to CUNY at that point, and I wanted to work with him. I also really wanted to live in New York City. And this guy I was dating, who I was pretty sure was going to be my life partner, was going to be going to NYU. So all of those things combined made CUNY a really easy choice. It was also affordable. I had quite a few loans coming out of Oberlin. And I could make CUNY work. I worked a lot of part-time jobs, but we made it work in a way that we might not have been able to make other schools work. So.
Okay, I have so many questions right off the bat. First of all, we have so many similarities. I was also a violist, and that was my first instrument that I started playing around 8 or 9. And I also spent my early years in Denver, Colorado. So I know, long story, but my parents are divorced, and my dad lived in Colorado. My mom lived, like, moved to Phoenix once I was like high school aged. So then I ended up kind of moving to Phoenix full time around high school, and I graduated high school in Phoenix, but I was bouncing back and forth between Denver and Phoenix a lot. And Denver's like my favorite city ever. So.
Great city. And it's so funny you say that because when we were living in Arkansas, my parents got divorced and my dad moved to Cal State LA for his job. And my mom moved us back to Denver. And so I was bouncing back and forth between Denver and Los Angeles a lot. And
Wow.
I vastly prefer Denver to Los Angeles.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. And my dad now lives in California. He lives in Santa Barbara now.
Oh, that's such a good city.
Is. He loves it. He's riding his bike along the beach. He loves it. Okay. So when you started your time at Oberlin, and it sounds like, you went into it kind of knowing that you had all of these different interests that you wanted to get into, and you got a minor in music theory. Okay, so when did you decide, or why did you decide, to pursue music theory?
Well, I wish I could tell you that I was just so driven to be a music theorist that there was no other path that I would ever consider. But the truth of the matter is, I knew by time I was a sophomore that I didn't actually want to be an orchestral musician, and that was what I thought I would do as a violist. I was concerned about all the nighttime rehearsals and the nighttime concerts and the Sunday concerts, and if I were lucky enough to be in a really important orchestra. Tours every summer. And that sounds really glamorous, except I was pretty sure I also wanted to be a mom and raise a family. And I know you can do that and be away nights and weekends, but I didn't want to. I wanted to be home nights and weekends. Plenty of people have raised amazing families with different schedules. It just was more of a sacrifice than I wanted. I also never loved practicing. I love playing, but I never loved practicing. And I didn't really see myself putting in the hard work it would take to get there. And if I got there, I wasn't sure that I actually wanted it. So I let go of the viola dream, and luckily my studio teacher was so supportive. I might not have articulated really clearly for him that I was letting go of the viola dream, but he knew I was struggling. And then I said, okay, well maybe I'll be a mathematician. And I like math. I'm good at math. Frankly, I'm a walking stereotype, right? I'm Japanese American, and I'm good at math and music. It's a horrible thing. And I worked hard at math, and that's actually the main reason that I was good at it. The pattern recognition, the joy of really difficult things. That's when I was good at it. But when I looked into what it takes to be a PhD in mathematics or a mathematician, it sounded awfully lonely to me. And I don't know if it actually is, but that's the way I coded it when I was, 19, 20 years old. And while I'm an introvert, I do really like people, and I didn't want to be in a job where I was just by myself, kind of intellectually all the time. And then in the middle of all this, one of my colleagues who was a couple years ahead of me at school, he got a full ride to Yale for music theory. I was like, oh, I bet I could do that. And that was kind of it. Like I was good at music theory. I really enjoyed it. It wasn't hard yet. It got hard later, but it wasn't hard yet. And it was musical. It was so musical. And it would require me leaving music. So I decided that I wanted to be a music theorist and became a music theory minor, which I think was not a good decision. I think that I should have instead taken more classes in the college. I wish I had taken a feminist studies class. I wish I had taken a rhetoric and composition class. I wish I'd taken an econ class and a psychology class. Like the list of I wishes is really long. I don't think I needed six upper division courses in music theory with wonderful instructors, because that was more like a master's degree that I did without a thesis. And I think the undergraduate should have been spent becoming broader and becoming a better writer.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, I also have similar sentiments thinking back about my undergraduate experience. I think that had a lot to do with the requirements of the degree. I ended up getting a voice degree, a degree in vocal performance, because by the time I got to college, I got really interested in opera. So I ended up switching from viola to voice, and still identify as a singer and an active performer. But yeah, I look back and I'm like, yeah, I wish I had taken like an African American studies course or a women's and gender studies. Oh, there was no time. I was practicing all the time and having recitals and ensembles and all of that stuff. And I also echo your sentiments about kind of the sacrifices that a performance career requires. And I was really set on being, an opera singer and that being my main gig and only kind of musical passion that I would pursue, and then ended up realizing that I was interested in engaging with music in a multitude of ways. And that being, quote unquote, just a performer no longer felt satisfying to me, I think, around the time that the pandemic started. So that's when I started getting interested in music theory. But thank you for sharing all that. So let's talk about your time in grad school. How was that? And what did you end up doing your dissertation on and all of that?
Grad school was great. I loved grad school. I think what I loved about it was a reset for me. At Oberlin, as an undergrad, I had put myself into a cycle of working 30 to 35 hours a week, as well as keeping up with my studies. And I wasn't having any fun. I didn't have any fun. Grad school, I reset that. I had lots of fun in grad school. I'm really glad I gave myself that gift of having some time to have fun. I also worked really hard. I enjoyed having seminars that only met once a week, and having the time to prepare for class over a week rather than 3 times a week or 2 times a week. That freedom sat really well with me and gave me space to do quality work. I also had time to pursue some hobbies that I didn't pursue in undergrad. In particular, I played a lot of contract bridge, or duplicate bridge, as they call it.
Ooh.
And I think I was well on my way to getting a PhD in bridge instead of a PhD in music theory. And it's a good thing that I left New York City when I did. It is a wonderful, wonderful game, and I still play it regularly. But grad school was good. I went straight into a PhD program. I got what you call an en route master's from Queens College and then my PhD from the Graduate Center. I got my first teaching experience. I taught either very late or very early classes at Hunter College, 7 a.m. or 7 p.m.
Woo, Lord.
Yes, that's what the grad students get to do. And the reason why the classes are put then is because these are folks working full-time jobs and they're going school before work and after work. And it was such an inspiring experience for me because they were all older than I was, without a doubt. And they were sending money home to families in countries that are not America. They didn't always do their homework, but they did what they could. And it was kind of my first step to really realizing that you can be an exceptional student and not earn A's. And that's not a cognitive dissonance. Like some people are juggling a full-time job, supporting two households, and trying to get a bachelor's degree. They're an exceptional student. It was incredible. And that was a really early formative experience for me in terms of my teaching. I also w was not a good teacher. I A plus for efforts and A plus for intent, but the execution, And looking back on it, I feel so badly for my students. And I had, some mentors who would help me a lot with my teaching and thinking through that. And they were so generous about not telling me how bad I was and instead helping me ways of being better.
Shout out to Lydia. Last year, it was not my year as a teacher or a student.
I was there over 9/11, which was scary and hard. But I left after 5 years. I left to take a VAP job. And when I left, I had defended my proposal or submitted my proposal. It had been accepted, but I hadn't written a word of my dissertation yet. And it was very good of me to leave because I needed another reset so that I could actually get my PhD in music theory instead of playing cards.
Wow. Okay, this is fascinating because I have been thinking about this more and more as I start getting to the dissertation phase. I'm about to finish my last year of classes. I'll write my proposal in the next year. And then of course I'll be ABD. And I've been thinking about this as I near, especially because, okay, people, I'm on fellowship after this year, which is really exciting, for both years 4 and 5 of my degree, which is huge, so that I can hopefully finish quote unquote on time. But I have been thinking about this as someone who is on fellowship and won't be teaching classes. Once I hit that ABD stage, like, am I going to consider, applying for a lecturer position or something like that? And I'm so worried that I wouldn't be able to focus or finish because I would, be so busy. So tell us about that and how that worked out.
Well, in some ways, it was good because I moved somewhere where I had no friends. I had no people, no one to play cards with other than my husband. And I had a library, an amazing library at my fingertips with no other grad students wanting the books. So that was all really good. I worked like a fiend during my breaks. So, fall break, winter shutdown. Oberlin has a January term. So, our classes ended last week and we start back up the first day of February. And so I'd have a good 7 weeks to crank out some stuff. And then I don't remember what I did. I don't think I worked every day on the dissertation, but I think I worked most days on the dissertation. CUNY didn't at that time, I don't know what they have now, but at that time they didn't have like a rigid schedule. They're like, just get it done. Which is hard for me. I work better with deadlines. So I churned out chapter after chapter and sent them off to my very large committee, and we waded through it. It's not the most amazing piece of scholarship, and someone gave me two pieces of advice about dissertation writing that really helped me. One is your dissertation isn't going to change the world. It's just not. So it's okay. And the other one was that dissertations are never done. You just stop. And that was really helpful for me to hear because you want it to be perfect. It's the biggest thing you've done so far in your life. You want it to be amazing and representative of you. And to have someone with, 20 years more experience in the field than me say to me, it's not going to change the world, so let it go. And you're never going to be done, so just stop. Just stop. I found both of those really freeing and true. And to this day, I don't think many people have read my dissertation, and I'm really good with that. Anything that was really worthy of development, I've developed. I've pulled it out. I've turned it into articles or conference papers. And it served its purpose. It launched my career. I got my PhD. I had fodder for my first articles. I had ideas for future avenues of research. And in that sense, it was a completely successful dissertation. And it was a joy to write it and a joy to defend it. I really enjoyed the work.
Wonderful. So let's touch on before we move on, let's touch on the research that you did for your dissertation and, like you're saying, how that has manifested into other avenues for work.
I was writing in 2002 to 2004, and that was after Bill Kaplan's Formulae Are a Book came out, and right about when sonata theory was emerging. So, as an Oberlin graduate, I had access to a lot of the ideas of sonata theory because both Warren and Jim taught at Oberlin. That's where their collaboration started. And Warren was my theory two teacher. So these ideas were floating around anyways, and Warren had generously given me early drafts of it to work with. When I was studying for my comps, I ran into probably a footnote in William Kaplan's book that said something along the lines of the role of multiple secondary themes has not yet been investigated. And God bless Bill Kaplan. And anyone who leaves footnotes like this in their work, that's a dissertation topic. So that's what I did with my dissertation. I explored, I called them multiple new key themes in sonata form expositions. That was my very wordy way of avoiding the secondary theme versus subordinate theme. So multiple new key themes in sonata form expositions and what role they had. I looked at it from a Shankarian point of view, from a Kaplan Formin Lehrer point of view, and from a Hepo d'Arcy sonata theory point of view. Threw in a history of theory chapter and summed it all up. It was so much fun. I really, really enjoyed it.
I'm glad to hear that. And okay, again, officially, before we officially move on from this time in your life and we talk about your current work and endeavors, I'd love to hear a piece of advice that you would give to current grad students. You already gave us some about dissertation writing, but anything also related to research, related to teaching for the first time, as you shared that it might have been a rocky start for you, as it was for me and continues to be. So anything related to researching for the first time, reading academic texts for the first time, teaching for the first time, or just being in grad school and how to navigate that.
Okay, I'll try to do three. We'll see if I remember. Reading academic work, my advice here is read the introduction or abstract, read the conclusion, and then go back and skim the whole thing. If it's something that really is personal for you, like right in your field of research, you cannot skim the whole thing. You need to read as though you were one of the blind reviewers for the journal. Like you need, in those cases, you really need to read looking for weaknesses in the argument, looking for what ifs or what abouts, digging into the musical examples. But for most of what you need to read in grad school, you need that that bird's eye view of the argument.
Hmm.
What is this author trying to say about this topic? And while the devil is in the details, if you can get that overview really solid, you will stand out amongst your graduate student peers. And preparing for class, I would say get the overview and then write down 3 to 5 details of the argument that you liked or hated or didn't understand. Everybody loves someone who asks a question. For dissertation writing, open the document every day.
Oh,
I don't.
Lord.
I know. I don't care if you do nothing with it.
That one hurt.
Open
Listeners, that hurt.
the Open the silly thing every day. You will probably write a sentence or revise a sentence. And, some days you're going to write a paragraph, and some days you're going to write 1,000 words. But no day will you write 0 words. And by one of the problems for me as where I am in my career right now is when I want to return to a project that I'm not finished with, it takes me like 2 weeks to ramp up to the level of knowledge and engagement I had the last time I was writing deeply. If I had opened my document every day, I wouldn't need that 2 week ramp up time. So it's a time saver. Even if you only read one sentence, think of it as your future self will thank you so much if you just open it every day. As for teaching, the one piece of advice I would give is to get an informal evaluations back from your students early and regularly, especially when you're just starting teaching. So in the 4th week or the 3rd week, it is really wise and helpful to give what we call a KSS evaluation. So the K stands for the question, keep it, it's working for me. So something, sometimes I list the activities we do in class or the course structure or the topics we're working on. Sometimes I just leave it open. So that's the first K. The S is stop it, it's not working for me. And the last S is start it. This is something that would help me. And when I say I'm leaving out the most important verb, keep it, it's helping me learn. Stop it, it's not helping me learn. Start it, this is something that would help me learn. They're anonymous. You give them to the students. They're usually incredibly generous and they will be really helpful. Often they will also contradict each other, right? I'll have half of the class say in RL Skills 1, this class moves too slowly. And the other half of the class will say, please slow down. We're moving too quickly. And I can put those numbers up for them so that they can see, what's going on with the class. And other times they will ask me to stop doing something that I think is really important. And I can say, I see that this is an ask of you, a big ask of you. And here's why I'm going to keep asking you to do it and really lay out for them transparently the reason why I believe giving them dictations and not the home key is really important. So, and it doesn't win them all over, but at least they realize I'm not just being careless, being really thoughtful. And students respond really well to intentionality. They also know when they're learning, and it's really helpful. So my first couple years teaching, I would give them out at week 3 and week 7. The evaluations you get back in week 14 are not helpful because you can't change anything for those students. But if you listen to them in week 3 and week 7, you can tinker with your class. And I still do this because students change over time. I've been teaching now for 22 years in my current job, and students are vastly different than they were when I started. I can't teach the same way that I did 15, 20 years ago. So there's all my advice.
Thank you so much. That was really helpful. And I know that I will definitely benefit from it as well as any other students that listen to the podcast. So thank you for sharing. So let's talk a bit about your current work and your current tenure as the president of SMT. So when did you first get involved with like the executive board and SMT and all of that? What led to this point?
The very first thing I did with SMT was I was the student representative on the professional development committee.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what that was. It was a lot. It was Terrific. I really enjoyed serving on that committee, and I met some nice people. And I'm not sure where it went from there, but eventually I ended up chairing the Committee on the Status of Women, which is now renamed the Committee on Feminist Issues and Gender Equity, which I love that name. I'm a big fan of that name. And actually, before that, I was elected treasurer. That was a big job. That's a 4-year commitment with a lot of details involved. And so that gave me 4 years of executive board experience. And it's so inspiring to be on the executive board. The folks in the room love SMT so much, are such amazing scholars and pedagogues, and really give their insights and their talent and their time to the organization. I'm always deeply impressed by the conversations we have in that space. And then it was a couple springs ago, I got the dreaded email from Ian Quinn, who was chair of the nominations committee that year. I'm like, oh, they want me to run for the board. That's so cool. And I read the email, I'm like, no. I don't think that's really what they meant to say. And I wrote Ian back, and I was like, let me think on it. And I talked with the president, it was Michael Buckler. I talked with the president about what was involved. I talked with mentors and friends. And my chat with Joe Strauss was probably the most helpful one of all of that. And he said to me, I can almost hear his voice, Jan, I have to write a lot of bios. But the one thing that is in every bio that I write for myself is that I am a past president of the Society for Music Theory. He says, it was just so meaningful to me, and I think you should run. I said, but Joe, I'm too young. I am too early career. I am not a big scholar. I don't think I'm a big scholar. Other people will disagree or agree with me, but I was like, why me? And he's like, how old are you, Jan? So I'm What was I then? I think I was 47 or 46. I don't remember. 47, probably. He says, you're the perfect age. You need to do this. I don't think it matters what words came out of my mouth. He would have told me I was the perfect age.
I love it. Dr. Joe Strauss, please come on the show. I'll send you an email. Come on the
He is a wonderful mentor, just a tremendous, tremendous human being. And obviously an amazing scholar and teacher, but as a mentor, he holds a special place in my heart. Yeah.
Okay, wow. Well, again, congratulations.
Thanks.
You've been at this for a while, and I'm really excited for hopefully the things that you and the rest of the executive board will accomplish during this term.
When I was thinking about what I wanted to do as president, first of all, I'm very inspired by Oberlin College's current president. She started her own podcast. You should
Oh,
listen.
cool.
Her name is Carmen Amber, and she is tremendous. And I think she is a model of leadership that I aspire to. One of the things I've noticed that she does is prioritizes what she wants to accomplish in a year and or 3 years. And she keeps the college running just fine. I mean, the pandemic made it really hard, but she kept the college running. And but she puts her heart and her soul into one or two objectives. And I've watched her do this, and I've been part of the receiving end of that as someone she asked to help implement something. It's tremendously impactful to choose one or two things. So I decided I would choose one or two things that I would really give my heart to as president. Of course, I want to keep the society running and healthy and all these things. But the two things that I chose were, one, we got to untangle our fundraising. We're to the point now where we need to do a better job with annual donations because we are spending more than we're bringing in, and that's not sustainable. So we've just never had a consistent approach. We've had a chain of really wonderful development committee chairs, but there's no continuity. And so that's one of the things that I think I could gift to the society, leave it in a better space than it was before, is by trying to untangling that. And so that's very practical. And then the more aspirational one is I would really like to increase the sense of belonging people feel in the society. And I am worried about all sorts of people who I know who don't feel a sense of belonging. But I am kind of worried about not Joe Strauss, but some of my mentors and elders feeling left behind in a way or unwelcome in the society because Shakarian or because they're a set class theory person. And there is a sense of disdain sometimes for those methodologies that makes me sad. And so, I'm interested in increasing a sense of belonging for everyone, but these folks are also on my mind. And that's a slower one. And I think this year will be about laying a lot of groundwork there. And then maybe year two, I can come up with some ideas or just even talking about it, having words for it and acknowledging it, I think is a good first step. So I don't know what the future of the society looks like, but those are the two things where I'm going to be putting my heart in addition to making sure that the society is healthy and alive and all these things.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. One of the things that comes to mind is I last year in 2022, while I was in New Orleans for SMT AMS SEM that year, I also ended up getting into ASA, the American Studies Association Conference, which was also in New Orleans. So it ended up working out. I had like 12 like really crazy days in New Orleans. And ASA, they theme their conferences. And so I believe the one this past year was like, the theme was like solidarity, colon, what love looks like in public, right? Like things like that, that I wonder if that's something that we could incorporate. Not necessarily that that would like, I don't know if that would, change the submissions or anything like that in a particular way, but maybe just to have, a theme or a phrase or a set of words that are on people's minds when they attend the meeting, to make the goal clear if the goal is belonging, if the goal is solidarity, that would be expressed early and people could kind of prepare for that or think on that before they attend the meeting. I don't know.
I love the idea, and I've actually bounced similar things to that. Not just me, a bunch of us have bounced similar ideas around. And one of the pain points of that is we wouldn't want to have a theme that excluded people from submitting proposals
Sure, sure,
when,
sure. Yeah.
especially for graduate students and early career scholars, an SMT presentation is incredibly important for your career. We're here to support everyone, but those conferences are really important for building resumes.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to figure out how to do a themed conference when our research interests are wonderfully rich and broad.
Right.
So one thing, and this didn't work either, but I thought, well, what if we have a threaded conference? I made up that word. So a conference where if you wanted to follow a specific thread of ideas, you could through the entire conference. And while that idea didn't take for Jacksonville, one thing that we are doing in Jacksonville is we made a call to, we would especially welcome special proposals on academic freedom in particular, because we're in Florida. And
Right.
I don't know about you, but I'm a little worried about academic freedom in Florida.
Sure.
We let all of the standing committees know that this was something that the program committee would be doing. And if they wanted to jump on board and do their sessions around ideas of academic freedom or how identity comes into scholarship or identity comes into music. And so there is a possibility that there will be a thread of presentations that you could follow through the entire conference related to academic freedom. But theming the conference worried a lot of us because we wanted to keep the kinds of scholarship we value as broad as possible.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you don't want the theme to be limiting. But yeah, I wonder, that's a, I think, a really fantastic goal in terms of thinking through collectively how do we encourage a greater sense of belonging and of togetherness or of solidarity. So I'm excited, first of all, that hopefully people can start to think about it when they listen to this podcast, and so that other people can be involved in collective thought or collective action around that goal.
That would be amazing. And I'm not hard to find. You can find me on the SMT website or at Oberlin College. Mm-hmm. And SMT is not small, but it is small enough that anyone could write to me and they would get a response. Mm-hmm. So.
Great. Again, listeners, check the show notes for links to Jan and all of her work. Send her an email if you want to get in touch with her about any of these ideas. So let's finish up talking a bit about what you're doing now in the classroom. You have talked to me or mentioned to me on a few different occasions about a really interesting class that you're teaching called Questioning Genius. Can you tell us a bit about that class and what the course objectives are?
Sure. I first need to give you a little context for the class. When Oberlin revamped our core theory curriculum, we de-verticalized it. I guess the word would be we horizontalized it.
Okay.
So theory one and theory two are a strict ladder. But then once you're done with theory two, you get a choice of like this a la carte menu of classes for sophomores.
Ooh, okay.
So there's no theory three and no theory four. There are just these 200 level electives that are only for sophomores. Mm. Dedicated audience, people coming straight out of our two semester core that everyone takes. Simultaneously, I was teaching a course called Analyzing the Music of Beethoven's Middle Era. This is just a really fun course, sure. Right? Every time you dig into Beethoven, you get rewarded. It's like dopamine hit after dopamine hit. It's so much fun. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why it's so much fun is pretty much all of our tools that we use for Beethoven were made to be used for Beethoven. Hmm. So of course they yield really good results. It turns out that's a lot of Beethoven. And the second or third time I taught the class, I decided that every Friday, it was a Monday, Wednesday, Friday class, every Friday I would teach someone else's Beethoven. So Beethoven is my Beethoven. Like I love Beethoven. I think he's a wonderful composer. His music moves me. I enjoy playing it on my viola. I enjoy listening to it. Not all of his music, but his symphonic music, his string quartets, his piano sonatas. Mm-hmm. I adore. But not everybody loves Beethoven. That's kind of a silly thing to assume. So I had just had a string of guests in to talk about their Beethoven and to teach us about their Beethoven. This was during the pandemic, so Zoom was my friend. And so I had a Prince scholar come in and talk about Prince. And I had what I thought was going to be a jazz saxophonist, Gary Bartz, who's an incredible jazz saxophonist. You could just Google his bio. I thought he was going to talk about Miles Davis. And that's kind of what I asked him to talk about. But no, actually, Gary Bartz wanted to talk about Beethoven. And that was a great.
Okay.
And you just don't tell Gary Bartz what to do. So, I had someone in who was talking about Gil Scott-Heron. Mm-hmm. And just like all of these heroes, Beethoven is hero, all these musical heroes for other people. Mm. And that was wonderful. And I enjoyed it. We didn't do much analytical work. So Questioning Genius is my Beethoven course, believe it or not,
okay,
with almost Beethoven in it. Because what it's doing is it's trying to question the idea of genius. Mm-hmm. Who gets to be a genius and why them? Mm-hmm. It's divided into three units, but the course objectives are to analyze a wide variety of music with a wide variety of techniques. So I essentially teach them the theory they need to know for each piece. To come out with a couple of analytical techniques under your belt pretty solidly. Because, you know, if you only do a little bit of everything, you know nothing. Mm-hmm. So to try to get a couple analytical techniques to be able to articulate what a student values in music and to develop a nuanced definition of genius. And so the way we're getting there, the course is divided into three parts. The first part is we're like looking at who the geniuses are. So the students pick almost all the rep in this course. So we do four composers in the first unit, and these are supposed to be stereotypical geniuses.
Sure.
Now this is reflective of Oberlin students. So this year, this is the second year I've taught the course. This year they chose Mozart, and we studied the last movement of the Jupiter Symphony, which has a huge, amazing fugue in it. They chose Benjamin Britten.
Oh.
I know that French song cycle he wrote.
Yes.
We looked at Viel, which was an incredible piece that I'd never heard, and it wasn't on my radar as genius, but okay. We looked at a Joni Mitchell song from, not from Blue, Hegira. And
Joni
we looked at,
Mitchell.
I know, and we
Fascinating.
looked at a Stevie Wonder song.
Yes.
This is not what I thought we would
This
be
is
doing in the first.
so fascinating. You really threw me with the Benjamin Britten, and then it was like, wait, Joni Mitchell,
Know.
Stevie Wonder.
Yes.
Yes.
So wait, on the first day of class, I do have them write down their definition, their day one definition of genius on an
Sure.
index. Of course, I keep those index card and I give them back to them on the last day of class. But for each of those, we know we study it analytically. We get a sense of the form. We talk about what parameters are most forward in that music, and by parameters, I mean they're the parameters we structured theory one and theory two around, which are melody, bass, counterpoint, harmony, form, texture and timbre, and rhythm slash meter. What are the most forward parameters in those pieces? Let's dig into those. The second unit, we look at what the genius makers value. Like, who decides you're a genius? Well, today, one might think Pulitzer Prize winners and MacArthur Genius Grant winners are who's being picked as geniuses. So I give them a list of the last 10 years of Pulitzer and MacArthur winners, and they choose music. So this year we studied Rhiannon Giddens.
Oh, yes.
I know. We studied Kendrick Lamar.
Sure.
We studied Ikue Mori, who I didn't know.
I don't think I know that name.
She is a Downtown 2 musician.
Okay.
I didn't know there was a Downtown 1, so I've learned a lot.
Okay.
We studied Raven Chacon,
Okay.
and we studied Caroline Shaw.
Sure. Okay.
And that was really fun. Each unit also involves a museum visit, where we use the museum to frame kind of the ideas.
Very fun.
So it is really fun. And yes, and then the third unit is looking at what kind of structural barriers are there to who's allowed to be at the table.
Right.
And obviously race and class and economic status have come up a lot already in the class. For each of these composers, we're learning about their biography, what's going on here. We read a little light Malcolm Gladwell. We read some heavier, like people who like try to define genius. And they have a pretty good sense that having the right resources and being at the right place at the right time all really important to being a genius. So the last unit we did kind of a deep dive into one, I would say one and a half chapters of Dylan Robinson's book, Hungry Listening. His third chapter lays out a framework for categorizing types of inclusion or musical encounters is what he calls them. And so we kind of work our way through those four categories. We listen to the music he's holding up for those. We analyze when we feel like it's appropriate to analyze, and all of that. We also looked at, we did a dive into sonata form. So I wanted them to have some sonata form skills. So we looked at a Boulogne string quartet and a Fanny Mendelssohn piano trio and kind of wrestled with why aren't they fitting so perfectly with sonata theory? Why aren't they doing that? For Boulogne, it's just unfair. Sonata theory is really based on Mozart, and Boulogne is not Mozart. He sounds a lot like Mozart, but he's not. He has his own style. Otherizing him just because he doesn't fit sonata theory doesn't seem right. Fanny Mendelssohn didn't compose for the public stage, right? So no symphonies, no opera overtures, stuff like that. And those performance mediums are where these huge grand gestures like medial caesuras and essential expositional closes really stand out, trying to communicate in a big space to a lot of people. And so her sonata forms are a lot more subtle, I think. And they also don't fit into the mold. And so, you know, here it is. We picked two composers who are not white guys, and neither of them are fitting into the sonata theory mold. And there's lots of reasons for that. You know, Fanny Mendelssohn's more of the romantic style. But we've talked a lot about how the methodologies that we use will prioritize one composer over another. I think that was a really important takeaway for them. So that's what we do in the third unit. And then we did we went down the set theory rabbit hole, and I taught them how to get all the trichords. And
Ooh.
we looked at Elizabeth Lutyens, whose nickname was 12-tone Lizzie. And we looked, I know, right? She's a British woman. And we looked at Wendy Carlos. And I didn't
Sure.
know set with Wendy Carlos, but Wendy Carlos is, a genius that nobody remembers to include in the category of genius. It was really fascinating. And so it was a completely ungraded class,
Tell me about that. Wow.
If there's ever a class to do ungraded, it has to be Questioning Genius.
Sure.
I have a big problem with grades.
Yes,
I
yeah.
feel like our grading systems are usually set up to compare students to each other instead of comparing students to themselves and rewarding growth. I am really interested in growth. There are some skills where you have to get there, right? I'm definitely interested in growth and key signatures, but I'm equally interested in you knowing them. You need to know your key signatures.
Sure.
So I don't want to, sometimes people will say, yeah, but you're not interested in mastery if you're only interested in growth. And I think that's just a red herring. Like, not everything can be mastered.
Sure.
And in fact, learning is a lot more interesting when you're studying things that can't be mastered.
Sure.
And you, as a performer, you understand this. There is no perfect performance of Casta Diva. There's just amazing performances and performances that show growth. And like, wouldn't you want to hear someone sing that at age 20, 30, 40, 50, and 60 and see how they change? I think that would be fascinating. So the way this class works is there's 3 points of intense reflection on your learning, the end of each unit. There's a substantive reflection. And they're reflecting on their engagement both in class and out of class. So I make them go back and look at all of their homework assignments, and for each assignment, say how engaged, like usually it's a checklist. I completed this. I completed this with really good engagement. I didn't complete this, but I hope to do it soon. I just need to let this assignment go. Right? This is kind of the range of things. And which assignment were you the most engaged with? Which were you the less engaged with? And then to reflect on their in-class engagement, like butts in seat, are you present, both figuratively and literally? And then there's always some, meta questions about their learning. What's helping you learn? What are you learning about how you learn? And then kind of some summary, what's your biggest takeaway from this unit? Stuff like that. They have assignments every class. And I respond to all of their assignments. I engage with all of their assignments. Like, sometimes it's you're wrong, right? The set class is 014, not 034. Here's why. Maybe try the other ones again. Sometimes it's I really appreciate the way you nuanced your discussion with blah, blah, and blah. Other times it's like, this is a good paragraph. To get it to the next level, you need to cite specific measure numbers and evidence from the score. I'm looking forward to seeing your growth in this area. But like, I'm not putting letter grades or anything like that on anything. I'm just giving feedback. Their final, which are coming in right now, it's a portfolio of work. So they need to choose two assignments from every unit that show the most growth. I don't want their best work. I want the work that shows the most growth and to tell me why it showed growth. So that's kind of the core of the final portfolio. Other parts of it are, to articulate takeaways from each unit. I ask them to write a letter to their future self about how to do a sonata form analysis and how to find a trichord. And so that they have those. And then I give them back their index card, and I ask them to retype their day one definition of genius, and then tell me how it's changed and why. So And so they're good portfolios. I'm happy with them. What we really want students to do, what I really want students to do at the end of the semester is review all of their work from the semester one more time and figure out what they learned. Oh, the last question is, what grade do you give yourself in this course and why? So.
This is so fascinating. Even starting back with, your curriculum at Oberlin, once you get those core theory classes, the fact that there are two instead of four, and that they have a little more agency once they get to the sophomore level is already like, whoa, that's really interesting. And I'm sure the students appreciate it immensely. But yeah, the way that you've structured this course, even just the fact that you as an instructor are so engaged, right? So you are asking them to show up and to notice their own engagement and what they're learning and to actively be paying attention to that. But you as providing feedback, on every assignment, even though that's not graded, quote unquote, feedback, but it is important feedback that you are, zooming in on their growth, which allows them to do the same. Just a really fascinating method for assessment.
It is. I don't recommend it pre-tenure. It's a lot. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, wow.
I think the learning is really good. Really good. They can tell me what they learned at the end of the semester and how they know what they learned.
And also in terms of them getting to choose all the repertoire, is really fascinating as an instructor really keeps you on your toes in
Oh
terms
boy,
of
this is.
in terms of your own learning and preparation for the course. I imagine even the prep for this course must be like phenomenal.
It's real. I've learned to ask for help. So Ikue Mori is someone I'd never heard of, but I had several colleagues who've performed with her. And so that was a godsend. And they were just excited that we could study music written in the last 10 years in a theory class. So last year, when their final grades came in, I would say I had 40 students. I would say five of them carelessly gave themselves an A. And it didn't sit right with me, and I wasn't gonna. I told them, if it doesn't sit right with me, this is what I do. I go back and I read your unit reflections, and if the grade you gave yourself at the end of the class is out of line with your unit reflections, I'm gonna push back. And if it's not out of line with your unit reflections, you won't hear from me. And so it's fascinating. I've been watching the grades come in. I've seen several C's come in. I've seen a lot of B minuses and B's, and I've seen a ton of A's, and none of these are out of line. Some of the C's I think are a little bit harsh, and I'm having a hard time letting them sit there. But it's interesting.
Yeah, and again, by letting the students choose their own grades, you are really pushing back against academia at large's kind of definition of grades and of progress and of growth. Like you said, pushing back against that narrative of putting students in competition with each other and prioritizing, GPAs over genuine learning and growth, and like perspective shifting. And so, I just, wow, this whole endeavor is so fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing and for bringing it onto the podcast and giving us a lot to
Oh
think
yeah.
about.
It's been an adventure. It's been fun, and I've had to learn so much music that I wouldn't know. And I'm so grateful for that, because that's the best part about teaching, is you're constantly learning, and I feel relevant, and that makes me really happy.
Fantastic. Okay, so let's finish up with a conversation. Another thing that you suggested that we talk about, and I'm just having such a great time talking to you, so we're gonna get to it all,
All right.
is you brought up you wanted to have a conversation about mentorship. And I think this is really interesting because I have not yet in these 60 something episodes on this podcast had a conversation about mentorship, about what a mentor is or what a mentee is, and about what that dynamic is supposed to look like. We did touch on it a little bit with Vivian Long when Dr. Vivian Long was on the podcast last year for Women's History Month. Yeah, that wasn't kind of the main meat of our conversation. And so I'm interested in why you want to have this conversation.
I think it's because I have more mentees than mentors for the first time in my life.
Hmm.
And so for me, it's like a pivoting moment. Also, my mentors are retiring and I'm kind of grieving for that. And it makes me really sad. And just because they're retiring doesn't mean they won't still mentor me. I do understand that. But there's something, I'm not 50 yet. There's something about feeling you're getting older. I just was promoted to full professor. I'm the president of the Society for Music Theory, and I refuse to refer to myself as a senior scholar. I can't do it. I feel like I'm still mid-career. I might be wrong, I might be right, but I feel like I'm really interested in mentoring and being a mentee, because I think it's something that we do on both sides that make a real impact on people's lives. I also think it's something that I've been on the receiving end of some really weird mentoring. You might be able to identify, oh, it's a woman in music theory. Let's make sure that her path is easy. That's not what any of us are looking for. We don't want an easy path. I want the same path everybody has. I don't want an easier path. So I just think mentoring and being a mentee is something we don't talk about enough, and it's really inherent in succeeding in academia to and maybe beyond academia. I don't know enough to speak there, but I have had a few mentors. So I mentioned Joe Strauss. The other mentor that's just been tremendously impactful in my life is Brian Alagant, who teaches at college here. And, I met him when I was a student. He looked at the list that I put together of grad schools to apply to all by myself because I didn't talk to anybody about my list. And he said, no. He wrote me a new list, and the new list he wrote me was CUNY, Eastman, Harvard, and Yale.
Okay.
I don't know what was on my first list, but none of those schools were on it. And so, starting from that conversation to, re just even recently, if I have a really naughty, KNOTTY, naughty situation on my hands, whether it's in the classroom or SMT or with reviewer number two, I go to Brian. Now I know, it's been a 25, 26, 27-year mentoring relationship. And sometimes I go and I just say, I need a gut check. And I'll lay it out and he'll give me a gut check and I'll walk out. And sometimes I have a really big problem and I sit down and we can talk for an hour. And I really value that. And it's had a profound impact on my career. I've also gotten to be a mentor, and and being SMT president makes it even easier for people to say, oh, maybe this person will give me some advice. And I love doing that. It makes me feel valued and happy. And I do have enough life experience to offer advice. Like, I won't call myself a senior scholar, but I do have enough life experience to do that. And I think it's really impactful, and that's why I wanted to talk about it. Oh.
Yeah, this is so fascinating because, along the same lines of your course, Questioning Genius, I've been thinking a lot about now. This is a bit of, ways away from where I'm currently at in my progression at Michigan, since I'm still finishing up my coursework and will be working on my proposal soon for my dissertation. But I've started to think about teaching philosophies in terms of, spoiler, I have no idea what a teaching philosophy is. Like, what is
No,
that?
nobody
What
does.
is that? And so thinking about like writing a teaching statement or whatever, again, I'm like a year or two away from this, but I'm still like, what is that? And so it made me think about this in terms of like, what would like a mentoring philosophy look like, right? Like what, in your opinion, I would love to know what makes a good mentor and what do you value about your mentors?
I want you to know I'm going to turn this question right back to you when I'm done. Because your perspective is perhaps more valuable than mine. But speaking as a mentee, I think what I value in a good mentoring relationship is, I mean, obviously kindness and honesty, but it's more than that. It's knowing how truthful to be and when to be that truthful. So, right, I send Brian Alagant my final exam for Theory 2 at Baruch College. I'm all of 23 years old. It is a ridiculous final. It's not good. He writes me back. He said, "Well, let's look at it this way." Really kind of gently laid out. It's like, I think it might be a bit much. Why don't you pick one or two things that you make sure you want to test and then pare down the rest? Did he tell me it was a ridiculous test? No. Did he say everyone's going to fail? No. Those were both true. He gave me as much truth as I could handle at that moment, both given how old I was, or not old, but how experienced I was and how close it was to delivering the final to the students. And I think that's really important. I think another thing that's really important in mentoring is to show how you can be available without being in someone's face. And I feel like assigned mentors don't work. It's a relationship that builds over time. And a lot of programs will assign a mentor, or a lot of tenure track jobs will assign you a mentor. And I don't think mentor is the right word for that. A liaison, an advice giver, a friend outside your department, something like that is all true. But being someone can go to with a gut check, I think, is really important. So, what do you think makes a successful mentor?
Again, I'm like, this is like the haziness of teaching philosophies where I'm like, I don't know. I hope my students pass. I don't know. But I
Do
think
you have mentors who've like really helped?
I do. I do. I think so. I think one of the first people that comes to mind is Dr. David Kerr, who's a professor at Roosevelt University, which is where I got my master's. And I was there at the onset of the pandemic. I graduated in 2021 with a master's in vocal performance. And while I was there, he was one of the professors who, kind of took me aside and was like, okay, you're writing some really interesting papers. Have you thought about getting your PhD? And I was like, no, that sounds weird. I don't know why I would do that.
Yeah, there we are. We are women who don't know our full potential. Maybe that's something good about a mentor, is they see potential in you that you don't see in yourself yet.
Yes, yeah. So that's the first thing that came to mind was he was not overbearing. He was not, like you need to do this or told me what to do, but he was just like, I'm gonna say this because it sounds like you've never thought about it, and I don't know if anybody has suggested it to you. So I'm gonna be the one to suggest, like, and to just reassure you, like, yes, you're a great performer, but you're also a really great thinker, and you're making connections, and you know how to write them clearly. And you could get into a PhD program if you wanted to. And, that seed was kind of all I needed for that to become a really attractive option to me. And so, yeah, someone who can provide you maybe just like a different perspective of who you are and who you can be. Because, like, yes, you know who you are and you are equipped to make the choices that are best for yourself. But to have someone say, ah, I'm just gonna like add this extra prism to it where like now you can kind of see yourself as I'm seeing you, not just in one way, but in a multifaceted sense. And so somebody that can remind you of kind of your multiplicity of selves, I think is really helpful. I also think one of the points that you brought up in terms of feedback, like somebody who gives you really honest feedback, but that is still kind, right? And coming from a place of wanting you to grow and not really wanting to like flex their knowledge or authority over you, but like wanting to see you improve. And so I can think of a number of people here at Michigan who are the right amount of like we are going to push you, but in an encouraging way and in a way that still is reassuring you like you can do this. We're going to work hard and it's going to be tiring, but it's never coming from a place of like of doubt, right? It's coming from a place of confidence. Like we are pushing you because we know that you can do it and you're going to keep getting to the next level. So yeah, I think about in terms of feedback style, especially you know, during my first year, receiving feedback for the first time was so hard. And it's still hard, right? Like, I still am in my feelings constantly. Y'all should have seen me writing this prelim. Like, I was... but I think at no point during, like, my prelim process did I ever feel like, oh, no, I can't do this, right? Like, or, oh, no, I'm going to fail, or I'm not cut out for this, right? That was, like, never, because it was never a doubt in my advisor's mind, it was never a doubt in my mind. And so I think that somebody who can see your multiplicity of selves and has confidence in you allows you to, you know, have confidence in yourself. And somebody who can still be honest with you with their feedback, like, who's not going to sugarcoat things, but who also is, you know, never coming from, like, a haughty or malicious place with their feedback. It's always for the purposes of helping you grow.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. And I think being a mentee is also, it's not a passive role to be a mentee. And I think a lot of people say, well, I don't know if I have all these mentors that you have had. And I'm like, I've worked at it, right? I mean, I haven't worked at it because as a game. I've worked at it because I believe relationships make the world a richer place.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've maintained my mentors. I keep in touch with them. I send them a holiday card, for heaven's sakes. It's adorable. I send them a holiday card with my family news. I touch base with them at conferences. When I have a question or a problem, they're there if I need them. Like, they'll write me back. They'll schedule a Zoom call. You know, sometimes that involves making yourself cautiously vulnerable, you know, when you're not sure about something. Professional things. I don't mean personal things. I mean professional things. And, you know, it's like, I just think I taught a terrible class and I'm feeling really off my game. Would you come see me and help me diagnose what's going on? Stuff like that, like asking for help, I think also makes someone a really good mentee. You'll get more out of your mentors too, because, like, you're both putting something into that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you can't be a mentor and say, knock, 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 hey, I haven't seen you teach in a while. Can I stop by? That doesn't feel good at all. that's not going to work.
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think as a mentee, just keeping nurturing a relationship, even if it's just saying, hey, just want to drop in and, you know, let you know that thing you told me 2 weeks ago, it's really working.
Right? Yeah, that is interesting in terms of, you know, how am I conceptualizing my role as mentee as, like, an active role and not just something that I'm receiving, but, like you're saying, a kind of symbiotic relationship. And even, you know, I've had to obviously adjust to, like, the practicalities of being a mentee, which is not, you know, asking your advisor for, you know, a letter of recommendation like a week before you need it. Bad Lydia, don't do that. Past Lydia, you know, has learned her lesson. Don't ask them if it's not, like, a month in advance, at least. But, you know, but yeah, knowing that it's an active relationship that both parties consent to maintaining, and can, you know, redefine the roles if necessary, redefine the terms if necessary, that it's a thing that can shift as you shift and morph as you morph. You know, like you're saying, to have a mentor-mentee relationship that's over 20 years, right? It's almost undoubtedly changed as you both have changed and as your careers have changed. And so, like, also being aware of how the dynamics shift as time goes on, how the needs might shift as time goes on, and also being open to having conversations about that it's a relationship you maintain like any other one in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or don't, right? I mean, one thing I've learned as I've gotten older is you don't ever have to ghost someone. You don't need to do that. You can just nourish that relationship less. You know, they text me and say, yeah, I'm good, how are you? And, like, you can just keep it surface. Like, you don't, you want to nourish the relationships that bring the best out of you and help you And a lot of, especially when there's a power imbalance, that those mentoring relationships, that you want to nourish the ones that help you grow. So.
I also think what's coming to mind, again, shout out to Dr. Naomi Andre, who gave me the advice when I was first entering Michigan. You need to be really intentional about having a few different people, right? Obviously, you want to spread it out and not necessarily, kind of throw all that towards one advisor or one mentor. But also, she was really adamant about, like, especially at a school like Michigan, which for the field of study that I wanted to go into from the beginning, right? I knew that I wanted to come into the program to research Black music, and there's not a Black professor, Black theory professor in the theory department here at Michigan. And so she was very, she was really adamant about, like, you really need to consider perhaps adding a whole other certificate, as if I need more coursework, but I did do it. I did follow this advice. You need to consider adding a certificate in African American studies or in women's and gender studies, because the theory faculty are very much equipped to help you learn the things that you need to learn in order to, like, be an academic in this field, but they are going to be lacking something when it comes to thinking about Black music. And so you need to make sure that you are meeting Black professors outside of the music department. And the marriage of those two things, like the expertise that you certainly are going to gain in the theory department with some great faculty members, and the experience you're going to gain in a women's and gender studies course, or in an African American studies course, or in a queer studies course, or whatever, wherever it is that you decide that your kind of secondary field is going to be, you're going to be so much more effective as a scholar, so much more multifaceted in your thinking, in your methods, and right, like, you're just going to be more equipped for the research that you want to do. And so she really stressed, like, you have to have some Black mentors, you have to have some mentors that are women, and you need to think about that early. And I'm really, really glad that she gave that advice. All of my favorite classes have been so far in African American studies or in women's and gender studies, and I'm getting a certificate in African American studies and diaspora studies. Again, no shade to the theory faculty. I've had a great time. But yeah.
Well, and as a scholar in the field, I am excited about you bringing that knowledge into the SMT space. Like, we're hungry for it in an almost unsavory way. Like, we were, I think we're so aware of our shortcomings right now that having someone in the field who's got a certificate in something other than music theory is such a strength. And I'm really excited to have you bringing that into the SMT space. And I know others will be too.
And that is going to do it for this episode of the podcast. Thank you so much to Dr. Jan Miyake for being on the show. This conversation was full of so many really important things for us to think about as a society, and I'm really excited to see how the society grows under her leadership. Again, check the show notes for the links to everything that we mentioned in the episode. If you want to reach out and you want to talk to Jan, or you want to talk to me about this episode, if you have other episodes that you want to provide your questions or comments or feedback on, if you have suggestions for what I should talk about next on the show, or you want to be a guest on the show yourself, please send me an email at hermusicacademia@gmail.com, or go to my website, hermusicacademia.com, and fill out the contact form there. I'd love to get you involved with the show. Until next time, thanks for listening.